Hello, and welcome to The Crate and Crowbar, a PC gaming podcast. It is the 24th of February, 2015. This is episode 81, astonishingly. My name is Chris Thurston, and I'm joined only by Marsh.
Hello.
Hi, Marsh.
Hi. Two little beardy men in a room.
That's all that's left of the beardy men. We've sublimated into...
Some of them have flown to far lands.
Others have...
gone to see men play indie music in Bristol. Like traitors, almost.
Traitors. So it's just you and me. Mm. The coziest ever episode of The Crate and Crowbar. And perhaps, in some ways also, the most disappointing. This week, Valve have announced that they will announce something that will probably be more available in terms of what it is to the public when this goes live. But that news... Oh, no, it won't be, because TDC's not till next week?
So when hang on, do we know what they're announcing, but the audience don't? I thought everybody knew.
Everyone does know. Right. But I assumed that the more information would have come out by Friday.
Oh, I see,
right. It probably
right.
won't have done. Will it?
I don't care.
Who knows? Anyway, Valve have announced that they're going to be finally showing off the finished version of the Steam controller, Steam boxes, or Steam machines, and VR at GDC, which is... the most substantial delivery on something Valve announced years ago that everybody forgot about this year.
How have they managed to deliver the whole VR thing? Because I thought they canned the people who were leading that project.
Well, I thought they lost some of them to Oculus.
Right, yeah.
So that's the question, really, is... I mean, I think everyone was kind of excited about Valve's hardware announcements last year. Mm. It feels like a long time ago, but it probably wasn't. And then there's a lot of fuss about it, and then it vanished completely as the, you know, they promised to redesign the Steam controller.
Well, they're very public layoffs as well. Well, yeah. They didn't intend to make them public, but they became quite public.
Yeah, and also they weren't layoffs. The people were placed in a cardboard box and driven into the countryside. The cardboard box was opened, and they left of their own accord.
Exactly.
That's how Valve work.
very egalitarian.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, it's what they would have wanted.
Mm. Yeah, I am quite excited, but it all depends on whether they fix the problems that I think are going to be inherent in the first cycle of VR technology, which is that simply the resolution isn't going to be up to snuff. Mm. Even if they double the resolution that we have in the current dev kits, it's still going to be, still going to get a screen door effect and it's still going to be pixely.
Yeah, I think what's interesting is they stressed VR, not AR, whereas previously all the Valve stuff had been AR.
Wearable computing and stuff.
Yeah, but they're actually apparently... going to show something that presumably is a Rift competitor. I don't know. It feels like that whole thing defined so much of what we were excited about 2 years ago now that it kind of strange.
I'm still excited about it, but it's just like, I want to see where this technology ends up, you know, when it becomes, it's only going to become kind of, like my excitement for it is contingent on it being a viable retail kind of proficient thing.
Yeah.
And it's not that yet.
Yeah. Hmm. It's funny, really. The whole thing seems to have stalled. Like, Google Glass sinking beneath the waves of...
I saw a person wearing Google Glass.
Really?
Yeah, in Bath.
Wow.
How the tendrils of twatishness have spread.
I mean...
even into the countryside.
Wow, that's... what was he doing? Or she?
He was walking.
Oh.
And looking superior.
That's hard to do wearing a Google Glass. I've actually never seen one in real life.
Mm. Well, it wasn't objective superiority. It was clearly subjective superiority that he was attempting to project, but failing.
Yeah, do you have any idea what he was using it for?
No.
Could have been doing anything.
No, probably scanning me.
Yeah, but I guess that man, notwithstanding the kind of failure of AR as a technology that people actually want, seems to have taken some of the wind out of the sails of what everyone was talking about 2-3 years ago now, which was that by now we would all be wearing our phones on our faces and our consoles on our faces.
Well, there's been the incredibly successful Kickstarter of that Pebble smartwatch.
Yeah.
Which is baffling. Like, isn't that a complete step back from what the proposition of all the wearable computing was? You know, Google Glasses seems much more attractive and interesting to me. I wouldn't wear Google Glasses, but that seems a lot better to me than a fucking smartwatch. I don't know how smart the watch can be yet.
I suppose watches are something people understand and have a place in society where it's kind of like wearing a camera on your face. That delivers you real-time information about the people you're looking at is maybe a step too far socially. Mm. I don't quite understand.
Yeah, I know. Watches seem like a vestige of the past.
I mean, it's me. Your wrist's not doing anything else.
No, this is true. But, I mean, no. the point at which wearable computing becomes interesting to me, like, not VR aside, like AR I'm talking about, is when it's completely transparent and you are interfacing stuff, you know, with your brain.
Yeah.
Say.
Yeah, replace my eyeballs. That's what I want.
Yeah, laser eyes.
Yeah.
But that's not actually, the laser eyes are a bit of a stretch, but actually the controlling things with your brain is getting more kind of close. Did you see that video of the, I think it was from DARPA, had two amputees, mind controlling fucking electro arms, not electro arms, mechanical arms, arms made out of pure electricity. And yeah, they were able to kind of, you know, pour water. They weren't kind of plugged into their nervous system in any way. They were just wearing a harness. I think it was capturing, somehow kind of capturing the presumably the, whatever, electromagnetic energy is produced by your nerves. I'm not a biologist.
Science!
You may have noticed my grasp of the actual facts.
It latched onto the Phoenix Force, powering every human being.
Exactly, yes. And, yes.
Yeah, but it's still a million miles away from being viable for anybody. I mean, you know,
oh yeah, but like in a decade, the stuff that DARPA will be kind of trailing for release a decade thereafter will be the fucking Deus Ex shit.
Yeah, but right now it's arms that don't really work and kickable dogs.
Mm, yeah,
like robot dogs you can kick.
Seems to be the favorite thing to do to poor big dog. Well, sorry for it.
Exactly, and that's how it all starts and ends.
We'll remember this.
Big dog will remember this. Telltale have been partially bought out. By, who is it? Owns the Hunger Games and Mad Men, and I've completely forgotten the name of the
Liongate.
Liongate, that's the one.
Hoping to make smart shows, or super shows, that's right.
That doesn't sound like a Microsoft pitch from 3 or 4 years ago, does it?
Yeah, that does sound doomed to failure. But then, I've tried not to be as mean to Telltale as I am routinely.
Yeah, I mean, they haven't really done anything really good for a while.
Well, it's...
Actually, people seem to like Tales from the Borderlands, so I don't know, I bet it.
It's because they haven't mechanically evolved in a way, and there seem to be lots of obvious ways that they could fix or tweak or move on from their current template that frustrates me. I think, like, remember the contrast between the first time I played a Telltale game on this podcast, or like the Telltale games post-Walking Dead. I'd played Telltale games before that, but they've obviously all been total dump. But after The Walking Dead, they released a bunch of games, including
Wolf Among Us.
And when I first played that, I was like, wow, this is great, because I never played that formula or thing before. Mm. And although it was very imperfect and lots of problems with it, I was kind of entranced by it. And then as soon as I got around to the second chapter, and the failings of that system became more and more kind of apparent to me, I know the love affair ended pretty quickly, and thereafter it has just been downhill. Like, they actually make me angry now, those games to play.
I think the worst possible fate for those games in that studio was for that to become a template you can apply any story to. It was a set of systems that worked for The Walking Dead. It wasn't a genre in itself, or a game framework that could be applied to any television show. Like, not every television show is the same. This notion that you can kind of like mash the two together and we'll have, you know, Mad Men, a Telltale adventure, or Hunger Games is way more likely, if not inevitable.
Oh god, yeah.
I mean, that's what everyone's saying, and I think it's completely accurate. That's not what Telltale should be doing. What they should be doing is being people who are the best at matching, a set of game systems to a fiction. Based on what that fiction actually is, not just, because I mean, it's going to end up as FMV adventures for this decade, really.
It already is there, I think. Yeah. Do you know anything about the history of Lionsgate as a film production company?
Nothing at all.
Because I mean, it seems like, I know they're a name that's familiar to me for a fairly large number of years, but I imagine that they've had quite a substantial boost in their prominence as a result of the success of The Hunger Games.
Mm.
So I don't know if that was just a canny acquisition of a particular property that's made them become like an actual kind of Miramax-sized
Warner,
entity.
Like a mini Warner kind of thing. Yeah.
But we'd have to ask somebody, like Nathan Dighton.
He'd know.
He would know.
But he's not here.
What have you been playing, Chris?
I have been playing Evolve, which was kind of, I guess, the big... Every February, there's a weird shooter. It's time immemorial. We had Titanfall. That was actually March. But let's go with what I just said. We had Bioshock Infinite. That came out in February. That's not the main and almost interesting thing I have to say about this game, but it did nonetheless come out in February. Yeah, it's... So Evolve is, I suppose, like one of the first big AAA games of the year. It would be the more pertinent thing to say about it, and one of the first games to kind of roll out with a kind of a fanfare. It is Turtle Rock's... Turtle Rock?
It is Turtle Rock, yeah. You're thinking of Turtle Beach.
Turtle Beach.
You're thinking you're about to confuse it with Turtle Beach, but you didn't. You actually got it right.
Okay. So it's Turtle Beach make headphones.
Yes.
Turtle Rock make Left 4 Dead. Yeah. So it's
how,
quite...
Can I just interrupt you then, before you get into this? How is Turtle Rock a separate thing from Valve? Did they not get eaten by Valve? Or were they just kind of sort of published Valve, and consumed by them?
The box Valve kept them in was very big and airy, and eventually they got out on them by themselves.
Wow, okay.
When Gabe drove them out to the countryside.
You need to dig those fences deep, really.
They do, yeah. The electricity on the fence went down, and momentarily, Samuel L. Jackson was killed while trying to restart the power to the fence, and Turtle Rock escaped.
Valve regretted breeding the most perfect kind of developer saw.
All of the developers were female. No, no.
That's not the most preposterous thing about this scenario. No, it is.
Yeah, somehow. The short answer is I don't know, and that's the plot of Jurassic Park. What I do know is that they have now made a game with 2K. Or is it Take Two? It's 2K. Things I don't know.
They're actually the same company.
Are they?
Yeah, they're different branches of the same company.
Well, I did not know that. And I probably should, because I've worked in this industry for 5 years. So, they have made a game. Like Left 4 Dead, it's a sort of part co-op, part competitive shooter survival thing, but with a much heavier emphasis on competitive. Its origins are in competitive Left 4 Dead, not the Left 4 Dead most people played, which was, you know, so it's in the version of Left 4 Dead where one team is the monsters and the other team are, or the infected and the other team are survivors making their way through a level. The pitch is that the player characters, who are, one of four classes, four players, are dropped onto a planet, to hunt down a monster that's played by the fifth player. So it's asymmetrical with a single very powerful player and four players working in unison to track them down. I guess if Left 4 Dead is a way of making a co-op or competitive video game around just like classic zombie movie scenarios, the touchstone for this is Predator, basically. It is Predator. It's not even Alien. It's or Aliens. It's 100% what if there were jetpacks in Predator.
Cool.
It's a really good pitch. I have a lot of problems with it. I've played about 3 hours so far and maybe some things evolved, but based on looking into the Steam stats for the game since it came out, 3 hours seems to be about what most people are playing of it. So I feel, feel equipped to deliver some judgments on what it's doing right and wrong. But like Titanfall, which is another game which had its community dwindle rapidly, despite, I would argue, its substantial merits, Evolve, when all the pieces fall together, is capable of producing really exciting, cool moments. So the example I was going to give is the first game I ever played as the monster. The way it works is you queue and you queue for a match and you order your preferences out of the five. So I most want to be the monster, I second most want to be the medic, I third most want to be the assault guy and so on. It was a game where I was playing as a monster, and as the monster, you run around and you kill and eat wildlife to level up, basically. But you're vulnerable while you're doing that, and you kind of have to do that out of the reach of the hunters. You can sniff the air to see where the hunters are, or if they're within your sniffing radius. But other than that, you kind of got to stick away from them, but they can see your tracks. So you're running away, and you're eating things and leveling up. And I think because I was matched with some bad hunters, they didn't seem to bother me much, and I sort of first encountered them just after I'd kind of leveled up to the second tier, three tiers of power. And one of them sort of like ran across, I could see or through the smell or vision that he was running across the sort of cliff top above me, and I was in a cave, and he sort of leapt down to the valley floor below, and he hadn't seen me yet, and I sort of realized that I make a lot of noise when I move, because I'm a giant monster, so it was time to kind of do something. So I sort of threw a rock at him, and then...
Is that just something that's on your...
Which is, I'll get into the kind of details of how that works. But the kind of and then, so this guy sort of, obviously would have just been, he's playing in first person, I'm playing in third person, he would just have this rock fly out of nowhere and knock him for six, and I come charging out of the Bosch is beating them up. Then his team arrives. We get into a big brawl. I'm using my flame breath and kind of like throwing these guys around. They're jetpacking around me, trying to lock me down. Eventually, I incapacitate one of them, but choose to flee. And I run off. And I clamber up a rock face and scamper across some mesas and kind of disappear into the jungle, and they can't keep up with me. And I decide to kind of like, they know what direction I've gone in now, and the hunt is getting more kind of more aggressive. So I go stealthy, and I'm sort of sneaking around to the extent that you can, getting stealth kills on the animals, which is less likely to attract birds that give away your position, or like send up birds from the undergrowth. So I managed to feed, and I am almost ready to get to level 3 when I notice that one of the hunters is actually quite close and he's separated from the group. And so I'm kind of, and literally at this point, even though I'm the size of a bus, I'm just waiting behind a rock, watching him walk towards me, like not moving at all. He's probably following some footprints he's found or something. And I'm like, I wonder if stealth moves work on, the stealth attack works on players. And it does. And so as this guy turns a corner, hopefully for him, this is a bit like playing a dynamic horror game.
Yeah.
Because he gets pinned down a bit like the hunter in Left 4 Dead. And I just pummel him into the dust to the point where he's incapacitated. His team is miles away. And then I just leave. And as they're kind of rushing to revive him, I find a safe spot and evolve into my final form where I have maximum powers and all this stuff. And the goal of the monster when it gets to the final form is to destroy a power generator. This is on one of the game modes. There are multiple game modes. To destroy a power generator, so that then sort of changes the attack a bit, because then the hunters have somewhere to defend. But they didn't actually find their guy in time, and so he's bled out, and there's only 3 of them left. He's respawning in 2 minutes, so I know this is kind of my time. And the power generator's in this facility that's sort of dug in the ground with multiple gantries and stuff, and I can sort of, I'm sitting on a rock overlooking it, and I can see that they're all sort of there milling about, kind of aimlessly, not really coordinating with each other and not looking for me. And I have like a ground smash leap attack. So I just think, I'm just going to start this boss fight and be the boss battle. So I start the fight by just sort of leaping off this rock and just sort of like sailing in the air and just smacking 2 of them to the ground, and then like unleashing my fire breath in a huge circle and kind of completely dominating the fight. I incapacitate 2 of them really quickly, including their medic. The other one kind of backs off and doesn't seem to know how to deal with me. And I start just tearing into the generator. And then he you know, gets closer and I charge and, like, pummel him into a wall. And I feel like a complete boss. And then destroy the generator and win the game. And that felt rad. Right? That combination.
That does sound pretty fucking good so far, yeah.
That sounds rad. And it is rad. And it's a testament to those mechanics coming together. However, I haven't had that experience since. Anything really near like it.
Huh.
And the framework that the game sits within is dreadful. And so basically, from that, like, kernel of this is the ideal, this is the experience you want to be able to generate from this game as a competitive thing, you can start to basically extrapolate its problems. Mm. Because, so just within the context of a given game, the way it works is, it's kind of a MOBA in a bunch of ways.
Really? Yeah. You have no lanes in it, right?
No, but there are, The maps are divided.
Which you're farming creeps, essentially.
Yeah. Right, you're farming creeps to max your power level. There are 3 different characters for every class, and there are 4 classes, and each character has 4 abilities that are mapped to the number keys.
Hmm.
So your guns are basically just abilities, and everything is moderated by cooldowns. So, you know, a particular medic might also have a sniper rifle that makes the monster vulnerable, and that's on a cooldown, or it's mitigated by ammo or something. And the types of videos they run to show you how a class or a monster works, the monster's the same way. You have 4 abilities that you level up when you revolve and you invest skill points into. If you've ever watched like a League of Legends hero video or for anything like that, it's very much that. It's like,
right,
the first ability is mines. You use the mines to do this, that, the other. What it feels like, I'm trying to sort of over the point. Basically, there's this fantasy that the game is built around, which is the monster and the asymmetrical encounter, and the moment when the monster leaps from the underbrush and snatches somebody, which can happen. But in order to build a fair, fast-paced, accessible multiplayer game around that, they have smoothed the edges off almost every potential interesting mechanic in that game. The reason that I had the match I did is because fundamentally my opponents were bad.
Right.
Had they known how half their abilities worked, most of that stuff wouldn't have been possible.
Hmm.
And that's because it sort of feels like that kind of, from a design point of view, that kind of, not feature creep in the way you might mean from Assassin's Creed, almost like idea creep, where giving a power to the monster requires a response on the hunter's side.
Right.
Until everyone has a set of powers that feel like they've departed from the core fantasy of the thing.
Mm.
So, an example is the monster has the ability to climb vertically. Some of the other monsters can fly. And this kind of necessitates that the hunters have some kind of movement ability. The hunters have jetpacks.
Yeah.
Which are more like boosts. They're not like, you know, they can't fly for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And so the notion is that the monster, if the monster runs or wants to run away, it can ultimately outrun them because it can climb forever, whereas the hunters have to boost. However, the vertical dimension of the maps means that that it would be really overpowering for the monster if it had unlimited climbing, whereas the hunters didn't. So there's a weird thing where if a hunter jets against a wall, they can jetpack forever.
Huh.
So if you go up to a vertical surface and hold the jetpack key, you will always glide up it. It's kind of like jetpack climbing or something.
Yeah.
And it's obviously like they've made one decision, then they made another decision, and then they have to make a different decision to compensate for the first decision. You know what I mean? And this kind
games
of like
it's really hard to balance, it turns out.
Yeah, it turns out it's really hard to make that work. And so rather than simplify or change the tack of the game, you end up with this thing where even in that one what should be simple system movement for the hunters, you have this weird exception that doesn't make any sense where your jetpack bar can be empty, but you're still able to jetpack because you're against a wall, because it needs to be able to do that or else the game wouldn't function. You know, similarly, because the monster is faster than the players, because it needs to be in order to be balanced, in order to be not just dead the moment it's seen by the players, the players need a way to stop it. And the game has some interesting ideas about how you might be able to stop it, like placing these harpoons that kind of tether it to the ground in certain areas, or like tranquilizer darts that slow it down. But the monster then is given ways of getting out of those things, so you can hit the harpoons and they immediately break.
Hmm.
So the kind of, the catch-all, the kind of, the way of solving this problem is, the class, the trapper, who's like the main person who's there to control the monster, can create a portable arena. And what it does is they throw up this massive laser dome that cuts off a huge circular portion of the map around where the trapper is.
Right.
And the monster can't pass through that barrier. And it's a completely artificial feeling restriction. I can understand exactly why it's there from a game design point of view.
Yeah.
Because ultimately, they need to be able to force an encounter between the monster and the players if the players want to have that, between the monster and the hunters, if the hunters want to have a fight.
Is that permanent then?
And no, it expires after a duration, but the monster's sort of forced to survive for a bit within the game. The game seems to be a lot about who wants to fight. If the monster wants to fight, they can pick the right location for them to, and then if the hunters want to fight, they force the fight using this device. But, and so I understand it, I get it from a balancing point of view, but it feels like at that point you've really departed from that kind of notion of what that experience should be. Like, as a monster, it's really frustrating to be confronted by that dome, because it doesn't really play within any of the rules that you've sort of set up about stalking the wilderness or anything.
Yeah.
And as a hunter, it's just at that point, I don't know, it feels inelegant, mechanically. And there's tons of stuff like that, like, abilities are really fiddly to use, particularly for the hunters. You know, the first assault class you get has mines, but the mines can't be placed on certain surfaces, seemingly arbitrarily.
Hmm.
And it's just fiddly enough to be noticeable every single time you use that ability. So there's a kind of, I'm sure some players will get good at it, but there is a inelegant fiddliness to just using your abilities that is compounded by what the game is otherwise doing.
Do you think what they're going for there is the kind of level of esoteric knowledge that MOBAs normally have? Like, I mean, obviously they're departing from the kind of clarity that first-person shooters often have, and certainly the kind of games that they put out before, like Left 4 Dead.
Yeah. I think, so, to maybe make a more general point, I think the reason it's weak, and admittedly I mostly played the one game mode, and there are other game modes that might mitigate this somewhat, is that it's fundamentally a game about moving.
Hmm.
I think it was Rich Stanton, actually, who used the Pac-Man analogy in his in his review, I believe, for The Guardian, which is pretty accurate. Like, it's four ghosts chasing one Pac-Man while Pac-Man gobbles up pellets until Pac-Man gets the big pellet and turns around and eats the ghosts. But that works for Pac-Man, because Pac-Man can't stop.
Yeah, okay, yeah.
The monster can and has to. And that's very tense. Like, wanting to stop and eat as the monster, but not being sure where the hunters are creates good tension. But there's pressure to keep moving because the hunters have no incentive to not move. They just go. The moment they land, they look for the tracks and they follow. And what this, the vast majority of matches I've gotten into, both as the hunter and as the monster, have fallen into this, like, tail chasing pattern where, you know, the hunters are given a million different ways to find the monster. There's no subtlety to the implementation of those ideas. Like, it uses UI prompts to indicate anything that might even slightly indicate the monster, because it really doesn't want you to lose them.
Including the cloud of birds.
Yes.
Cloud of birds?
So yeah, the flock of, when a cloud of birds forms, due to a hot and high and low pressure front.
I think I missed that geography lesson.
Like, that's the thing, like, so on paper you think that's a wonderful design idea, like, why not have the player track the monster by seeing the movement of other fauna?
Yeah, that got me really excited when you said that.
It just pops up a UI thing saying monster disturbed birds and then gives you a waypoint and a distance. See, God, that's exactly it. That's the point where the game was focus tested into oblivion. This is what I mean by the edges being sanded off. Like, it's like, that should be really nice and dynamic and interesting, but it's bollocks.
And yet the kind of arbitrary mind placement wasn't focus tested. I mean, that seems
like, and like, but this is the thing, like, and so what happens is you're given, as the hunter, you're given a breadcrumb trail of clues, which include glowing footprints. One character has a dog that chases the monster constantly.
Right.
Loads of ways to find it. As the monster, you're slightly faster, but you also contend with the fact that your jetpack is bollocks. So you're constantly running out of jetpack energy. So the game is constantly pushing you to move, but giving you reasons why you can't go as fast as you want to go, which is just, like, bad game design.
Mm.
As the monster, you constantly want to stop and feed, but the hunters are always just on top of you as they chase you around the map. And so you either have to have incompetent hunters who leave you alone for a bit, which is what happened in my first game.
Hmm.
Or I guess you kind of shake them. I did have one moment where I managed to actually shake them by hanging onto a ledge as they jumped over me and went in the opposite direction because they just completely didn't notice I was there, which was, you know, that was, I managed to pull off stealth as a bus-sized giant monster. So that was fun, and I guess there is something in getting better at that, but I suspect the experience for a lot of players when they start out is going to be, as a hunter, wanting to chase and feeling incapable of doing so quite as effectively as you want, and as the monster, wanting to escape and being able to only just do so as much as you want. So both everyone is kind of frustrated, there's no real breathing room, but it doesn't feel tactical either. You can ping the map as the hunters by pressing Q, and it gives you your teammates a kind of like little waypoint. And the closer it is to the monster, the hotter it is. So it goes from yellow to red. So if you ping the monster, if you see it, you can ping it. And everyone goes, oh, there it is, which is fine.
Yeah.
But what it means is whoever's currently got line of sight, the monster's just pinging constantly to leave a breadcrumb for the other hunters.
Right.
As you try and it's just, it doesn't, that's not what that chase should feel like, conceptually or from a game design point of view. And then you get close enough, you throw up the arena, you fight, you win or you lose. And honestly, I'm sure there is depth to it, but at the moment the fights seem a bit arbitrary. Who actually wins or loses when that encounter finally happens.
It's a strange game. I played it for half an hour before it was released. I think I was in the beta, and it ran like shit for me, so I didn't play it for any longer than that. But I found a tremendous sense of performance anxiety with the prospect of being the monster, because you're not... It wouldn't be a good game for your opposition if you crumpled and died straight away. Mm. You want to kind of have... You need to fulfill that the kind of fantasy that the game's putting out. You need to be a good monster. You need to be suitably threatening, and yet eventually die in the, you know, to fulfill the fantasy that is usually played out in these kind of monster movies.
Mm.
But I was just too scared to kind of do that, because I thought I, you know, first time I'd probably fail horribly.
I had one where I just got caught really quickly. Like, I was still the baby level monster, the first tier, and I just got caught, and the dome went up, and there was nowhere for me to go, and the dome went up in a very open area by a river, so there's no real cover and nowhere to climb.
But it's weird that one of the kind of incentives then for players creates a scenario that nobody wants.
Yeah.
Which is to win really quickly.
Yeah, exactly. This is what I mean by conceptual flaw. Like, I was thinking about it while I was walking home, what I think it needs. And I think it needs the hunters to require something other than simply to kill the monster. Obviously, I'm talking about hunt them, the one where you do just hunt the monster.
What's it kind of level up and farm their own kind of creature, or that kind of thing?
Yeah, like I love Natural Selection 1. I didn't play a huge amount of Natural Selection 2. And Natural Selection 1 was an asymmetric multiplayer game where the kind of marines, the humans, it was more based on aliens than Predator, but it had aliens that worked very differently to the human opponents, but it was a team multiplayer game. But nonetheless, one thing it did was create different but interesting ways in which the teams were vulnerable. In Evolve, the hunters are vulnerable if they're separated from each other, which some of the creatures have a way of forcing, but ultimately it's just on the players not to do that, and it's quite straightforward. There's nothing to really incentivize them to wander off or secure something else, because they're, you know, while there are objectives for them on other modes, like destroying eggs and stuff, what it really needs is for there to be, that for, basically for both factions, even if one player's on one faction, four players on the other, to exist in the same ecosystem, and to, you know, so maybe the monster's out hunting and eating people and eating wildlife to gain more powerful, while the hunters are also getting something out of the map, building a base.
Yeah.
You know, you want there to be the engineer one who's just there building customized defenses. Yeah, building a trap. And then the mine placement thing. You know, the reason the mines don't really work is because the game's fundamentally about running. So placing mines is just kind of like, shit, I'm going to throw them on my feet and hope it steps on them. You know, I kind of obviously want the scenario.
It doesn't work unless you're being chased, does it, really?
No.
And you're chasing.
Yeah. It's all out of whack. And, you know, maybe the other modes did this better. There are other modes where, like, it's more like a base defense game. There are hordes of monsters with one big monster controlled by a player and that kind of thing. But none of it feels like, all of it feels just inelegant as a consequence of being so rigidly compartmentalized into roles and, as so sort of almost so afraid of letting the games run long. You know, I would happily play that game if it took an hour to play through a given session. And it was, even if the monster only got one life, even if you felt like you totally wasted it, if you got caught at the end, you know, if it was like a movie length encounter with this creature, where the creature's got everything to lose, maybe the humans can respawn, but the humans are building a base over time that takes, you know, real investment, and you would really feel the loss of if you get parts of it destroyed. Like, it feels like it needs that. It needs all of the arcadey shit stripped away, and the kind of MOBA-style abilities, and this would be a different game at this point, but it would feel like what they've made is, like, you know, I don't know, sort of 90s, 2000 AD Kiss Chase.
Right.
So, yeah, I mean, that, I suspect, you know, people have had that experience, they've had their one great experience, and then they've had a run of sort of mediocre experiences, which can be generated by anything from having a mediocre player as the monster, for example, to not getting to play the role they actually want several times in a row, to all the other kind of potential structural problems with it, to just getting bored of jetpacking around after a creature that doesn't want to stop. But that's not the game's biggest problem.
It isn't.
No. The game is also embedded in a progression and unlock system, which is total garbage. And the game tries to make you happy about it by showing you more bars that are filling up. So you level up every single individual ability, weapon, and so on. You get global rankings for how much assault rifle damage you did and all the rest of this stuff. And none of it feels any good to do. It's just arbitrary numbers. In order to unlock characters, passives, new guns, passives for guns, skins, emblems, shit, badges, whatever the fuck else, you have to level up every individual class. So there are three medics by default, with more to purchase. There are three medics by default, but in order to lock them, you have to master the first one. So the medics unlock in a linear order down a progression bar.
Right.
Likewise, the other classes, likewise the monsters. And so there are huge amounts of different, and you also have an account level that does some other things.
An account level?
Like, you know, like, so in addition to having levels for the individual, each individual class.
Oh, I see.
Plus the monster, right, gotcha. You also have an account-wide ranking system. So when you finish a game, a million bars are filling up, and each of them represents a wearying reason not to continue playing that game.
I feel tired, you just telling me this.
Yeah. Like, this is bullshit. We dealt with this. We know this system is rubbish. Like, it is anti-competitive. It locks you out of the game. If you've just bought the game, you're staring at, you know, hours of play just to see what the other monsters are like. Like, this is supposed to be a competitive game. They got commentators in to try and turn it into an eSport.
Oh, yeah.
In one phase in that game's deeply troubled marketing. And you can't do that with a game where even basic stuff isn't available to the player from the get-go. I don't mind maybe having some additional things you unlock for a given character if you spend more time with them, but having characters locked away at the bottom of trees that I will never have the patience to see. If, you know, it's deeply wearying to finish a game that maybe didn't go satisfactorily and then see that you've progressed 200 points out of the 2,000 points you need to get to the next node on a long list, which is in itself on a parallel list of like 5 different nodes. It's like the worst of everything post-COD in multiplayer design. You know, I normally don't like unlock systems, and this is the worst one I've seen. For just feeling, it's not a breadcrumb trail of things to chase like the rest of the game is. It's just a brick wall that says you need to play this much more of this to get access to the thing you bought.
Right.
And they're selling shitloads of DLC.
Yeah.
And it's a platform, and it's got the, and well documented, like the worst spread of special editions you've ever seen. It's like, It's a.
How do they fuck that up? So
God, I don't know. Like, the core idea is really good. They have made half of that game, and
But even with all the flaws of that game, like, you'd think their marketing department wouldn't have made such a misstep as to suggest the kind of horrific DLC monstrosity that they're
proposing. Yeah, it does. You know? Like, the basic game has potential, and it's the kind of thing that, with a bit of love, and like, you know, it's the kind of thing you want to be. I'd probably be much kinder to it if it was a. Like, you know, like, in that kind of, that stream of experimental shooters, like Natural Selection 2 or whatever, where you've got like a 20 quid shooter on Steam that is really open to its community and the kind of developers are working on it all the time. And yes, there may be some balance problems and maybe the whole arena dome thing is a bit guff at the moment, but it'll be fixed in 1.2 and everyone will move on. Like, it feels like, cause it feels like a total conversion, actually. It feels like a great mod from a few years ago. You know what I mean? It has that kind of, when it's working, it feels like, you know, it could be like The Hunted or like an amazing Half-Life 1 mod that you'd remember forever. Like, yeah, and it has that DNA. That's where Left 4 Dead came from as well.
Yeah.
But it's, and so its flaws as a game, which I dwelled on quite a lot, can all be folded away in that. It can have those flaws and still succeed because, you know, ultimately they're trying something really new. And when it does deliver that experience, it does deliver that experience. But it's clad in the worst bollocks of the last couple of years AAA shooter design. Like, they just, like, the rest of it is trouble. That's the bit where they shat the bed. You know what I mean? That's the exact moment that it went from being like, this looks a bit precarious.
And you don't want to shit your bed during a kiss chase.
You really don't. Yeah, that's the thing. Like, maybe the kiss chase wasn't going well, but shitting yourself, that was really when you weren't invited back.
Mucky end.
It was a mucky end, yeah. So, if I sound frustrated with it, it's because I am, because I had that first experience and I really wanted to have that again, and every subsequent experience has been bollocks. And then, after every bollocks experience, I've been subsequently told that I am another 12% towards being able to have a 3% enhanced, less bollocks experience.
Do you want to play it this evening?
Yeah. I still don't want to play it, that's the stupid thing. And it's not the bars, it's just the promise. I think when I was younger and I was really into like modding and when I was into Half-Life mod specifically, I would forgive so much because I was in love with the fantasy of the game. And I mean, I like Titanfall. I would have absolutely adored this game when I was a teenager.
Yeah.
It's got like a John Carpentry kind of, you know, it's every shitty monster movie. You know, if you could play as the creature from Tremors, I'd be fucking all over it.
Oh man. Yeah. Although that wouldn't be a great visual experience most of the time.
No, but well, you know, like, I'd be completely all over it, but I'm like, maybe I was getting older, maybe I was getting more critical of games, but I'm less willing to forgive what I see as its excuses for not really delivering that, where it's like, you don't want to reconcile the different movement abilities of the classes, so you just add an ability that just makes movement irrelevant for a time to allow the game to happen. It's that kind of mechanical jank that...
It's weird, like, I mean, Blizzard have this thing when they're balancing games, they're kind of... Their mantra is never nerf. Is that Blizzard? I seem to remember that. Who is
pretty
that?
Much. It's kind of how Dota works.
But I don't know, right, yeah. No, we feel free. But I mean, like, the... obviously you never want to counter a power by taking somebody else's away, because that always feels bad. But it feels like, from what you're saying in this game, it's all over the shop.
Yeah. Like, it's, I mean, one of my experiences with it was that everything feels bullshit. Like, when you're the...
That's a box quote.
Yeah. Like, and it really is down to feel, and I think this is something they haven't considered. Like, they probably have, but like, it's been folded away or like answered with something else. It's like, on paper, there is a lot of bat abilities that function together as part of a strategic system. So the medic's flying around doing healy things and the support's firing a shield and the assault can make themselves invulnerable and you stagger these powers in order to kind of bring down the monster. That's fine. But what actually happens in practice, the way that feels, is pretty much everything the hunters do individually feels like it's not very effective. Because all of their abilities are designed to be used in sync with somebody else. The guy who actually does the damage needs to be able to survive it. So he needs the medic to be helping him, or his experience is just getting battered.
Right.
You know, the trap is there to slow it down, but your experience of trapping it is mostly having it escape your traps, because the monster needs to be able to free itself from the traps. If you're the support, the first support you get can call down a damaging orbital strike, but any given monster is just spazzing around all the entire time, and you're not going to stop long enough to be hit by it, so you need someone else to stop it, or you needed to get stuck. And so because of that independency, which is strategically interesting, nobody's abilities feel like they do anything.
Huh.
If you're all firing at the same time, you'll see its health bar go down quite quickly. But it's the World of Warcraft raid boss thing, where the most interesting thing can happen. It basically, if something interesting happens, something's gone wrong. which is the WoW problem, where it's like, oh god, guys, our DPS dropped by 2%, wipe, start again. Well, it's not quite that pronounced because the game doesn't really have that as a function, but you kind of feel that way if the damage goes off. It's kind of like, oh god, we've got to get the fucking damage hoover back up again. Leaf blower would be a better analogy, I suppose, than hoover. And then the monster's powers, these giant baffling things that you don't really understand when you first encounter them. You know, you're being knocked around, knocked back, thrown up in the air. You know, there's fire everywhere and you can't see and the monster's pummeling you and whatever. As the monster, you have these abilities, you know, big abilities, and it's satisfying to land them. But you're surrounded by these tiny little pricks that are constantly slightly inconveniencing you in a lot of different ways. And then you realize that the edge of their fucking bubble dome has like created a cul-de-sac, like a deadly cul-de-sac that you're now stuck in, because you can't kind of like turn to climb a wall because the context sensitive climbing is kind of wigged out because of where the radius of the bubble happens to have fallen, and you kind of die because you're stuck in a corner, and that feels shit.
Yeah.
And so it's sort of, they've created a scenario where it sort of feels bad for everybody so that it's fair.
Yeah.
And I think,
you know what this game would benefit from? It's a game I've been thinking about since, or maybe slightly before Sleep is Death came out, where how to incentivize somebody to DM a game simply, or to play an enemy, but to not try and destroy your opponents, but to actually give them a good show. And there are ways you could do that. I was thinking about this in a kind of, I think there were games that were announced shortly after this, which were kind of like, you were essentially building like a raid dungeon for people to invade.
There's Mighty Quest for Epic Loot.
Yes, the Ubisoft game, exactly right. Except in that game, your incentive is to just kill people who come into your base, as it is in the Castle Doctrine. But I think there are surely incentives you could provide to get somebody to make, just to kind of make that experience as kind of dramatic and exciting and long as possible.
I think,
without actually just slapping the players down.
I think what it needs, and this is what I was getting at maybe not particularly elegantly earlier, is it needs more complicated objectives. Not just in terms of like victory conditions, but in terms of what the players want in a minute to minute basis. At the moment, the game that it is the hunters always want to find the objective, always want to find the monster.
Yeah.
So the point of the game is to ignore the environment and just fucking run in a direction. Follow the dog, basically. It's a game of follow the dog, and then when you see the monster, press Q. Until the person can press the bubble button and then fight. Right? And it's because there are no more granular objectives than that. There are no smaller victories for the hunters than killing the monster. The hunters can kill the wildlife so the monster can't eat them. It doesn't really explain why killing the wildlife doesn't sort of allow the monster to eat the thing, but whatever. So, you know, I guess you get a small victory in successfully clearing an area of wildlife that the monster might be able to feed on, but that's not really relayed to you in any tangible way. So the hunters can't really lose slowly in an interesting way, because the objectives for them are pretty binary.
Mm.
It's the monster, you know, kill yeah. monster or don't kill monster, die or do not die. Likewise, the monster has maybe a couple of objectives, protect some eggs, kill the power generator, defeat the hunters, but they're pretty game-ending binary things.
Yeah.
In some ways, the monster has a slightly more interesting journey, because it can be interrupted while feeding and can have that kind of interesting experience of, I need to find some more food. It can also be like, I have enough power to evolve, but evolving makes me vulnerable, so I need to find somewhere they won't find me.
Mm.
So that's actually a good example of what I'm talking about. It has moments where its objectives aren't quite related to what the players are doing. They can't, well, it all affects each other, but what the monster wants and the feeling of having succeeded at something as the monster has nothing to do with what the players are doing momentarily.
Yeah.
That's what the hunters don't have. And for that reason, that's why I think it's so unsatisfactory, because, you know, if there was you know, the hunters were dependent on, you know, more like an RTS, if the hunters were dependent on resources that were gathered for them by NPCs, and they arrive at the mine or whatever to find that the NPCs have been slaughtered, then they've been set back in a way that establishes the villain that they're facing, the monster. It's more like the opening of Predator or the opening of a sci-fi movie. It gives the monster something to do, and it gives the hunters a kind of a new mini objective, which is sort of secure our resource line. And when that attack doesn't happen again, when it, you know, the monster is repelled the second time it tries, that's a satisfying mini win for the hunters. And at the moment, it doesn't really feel like there are any mini wins. It's just big victories or nothing. And that's why there's none of that dialogue, right? Like, it's why the monster doesn't really feel like it's GMing the game. Because, like I say, in that anecdote where I felt amazing because I'd kind of killed this guy who'd wandered off, it required him to wander off. Mm-hmm. There's no reason to do that. That only happened because he was bad. You know, if he'd stuck with his team, I wouldn't have had the power to do something like that to him or to, you know.
Maybe in a good horror movie tradition, he just really badly needed a leak.
Yeah, exactly. That's the thing, right? To return to an analogy we used right at the beginning of this, there is no reason in Evolve for Samuel L. Jackson to go alone
right,
to the power generator to become an arm. You know, like, like that really classic horror scenario of like, I've got to do this one by myself or wandering off isn't incentivized by anything the game really makes you do. You know, there's no moment where like, oh, the sensors have gone off on the east perimeter. Someone needs to check that out. Yeah. We can't leave here. Like, that's what it needs. It needs that moment. And it doesn't have it because it's just like, well, we'll all just wobble /jetpack/double jump/glide over there. Oh, anyway, the dog's going in a different direction, so let's just follow the dog instead. Oh, and also the UI has just told me that birds are over there, and the birds always mean the monster, so we have to follow the birds now.
Lame.
Yeah! Yeah! Eights across the board.
Yeah, that's weird. Let's play it.
Yeah, okay. What have you been playing, Marty?
I've been playing a very different game to that. I've been playing Medieval Engineers, which is the sequel to the also still unreleased, still in early access, Space Engineers. But you can guess from the name that it is not set in the distant future of space-based building, but is based in the medieval era, where you build castles and siege weapons. And it's weird, because only a couple of weeks ago I was playing Besiege, which is this great kind of really cute, fun, physics-y sandbox where you build siege engines and attack castles, and you can kind of like just control a siege engine, basically, and kill sheep, pop sheep. And I was thinking while I was playing that, wow, I'd really like this game if I could not only build siege engines, but build castles as well. Because there's such an exciting history of kind of the arms race between siege weaponry and
walls.
And walls.
Their natural enemy.
Exactly. And lo and behold, this comes along. So it's a first person game, and it's in this lovely landscape, and you can just kind of pick from a selection of different prefabricated things. It's open to the Steam Workshop, so there'll be more prefabricated things that you can plug together in the future. And you just build your castles, and then you can smash the shit out of them. And what's amazing about it is that the physics of the smashing of walls really kind of totally fulfills the fantasies that I had about Battlefield several years ago. Mm. You remember all those kind of those tech demos where people would be showing off their destruction engines and we'd all gather around the computer and PC Gamer and watch the kind of like a, some kind of ballista smash into a wall and it all tumble down and bits of it would chunk off procedurally and we would go, ooh.
That was the future.
And then be like, this won't happen in games for 5 years. And it didn't. And now it is. It's great. You can, you know, and everything is like so, like, structurally dependent. Things have kind of resistances, you know, and, and weight and stuff. And so you can't build your castles really badly because they will just fall over. At the moment, there's no multiplayer. So you're basically kind of limited to smashing up your own castles. But that's kind of fun. There's some things about it as well. Like, there's no, some of the, blocks that they have. There's quite a restricted number of blocks in this early access build that you can put together, and some of the kind of stuff that they have already doesn't really fit together. Like, I've not found a way of really plugging round towers into other structures in a way which you can access their doors.
Right.
It's kind of important. But you can make things that look good, even if they aren't functional. But obviously, I want something that looks good and is actually a functioning castle. I built this. We've gone up a massive mountain and built this kind of fucking austere-looking promontory on the very peak of it. Kind of feeding back along a very long, tall wall into this massive fortress. Looks fucking rad.
Castles are cool.
They are cool. They're very cool.
Do you know what would be fucking rad? An idea I just had.
What's that?
Evolve, but medieval, and the monster's a dragon.
Ooh! Somebody make that.
Yeah.
That would be fucking hot. Yeah.
Fuck yes. But no, like, so... In terms of, what does it need, kind of game systems-wise, to kind of turn that into something that you...
I don't know if it ever will. I never played Space Engineers. I gather it was, it's basically just a sandbox, so there's no kind of pre-cooked gameplay that is forced upon you in any way. Apparently, one of the things that they're adding to this, as well as multiplayer, are barbarians, but beyond that bullet point, I don't know what that actually involves.
Barbarians.
Barbarians.
It's just, you know, barbarians.
But I assume you can press a button and have barbarians try and siege your castle. Yeah. I guess that's what it is. But I can think of lots of ways in which you could make that into a very kind of, overt game.
Mm. Yeah, well, naturally gamey, right?
Yeah. Well, we shall see, I suppose. The thing I want from it, though, I mean, this is what always frustrated me about Battlefield's attempt at destruction, is it never used that as a tactical opportunity in any way. It was just kind of really very surface level. And you can actually siege castles in this in ways which are
You
know, accurately replicate the strategic value of siege weaponry circa 15th century.
Man, I love that. I love it when games get to the point where you can kind of not better historical engineering, but like start to enter the same processes that made you go, oh, if this is angled in this way,
yeah,
it's much easier to defend against this kind of thing or whatever.
Well, that's exactly right. What I want is to be able to man a fortress. The thing is, I don't know how well the netcode's going to do with all of this stuff on screen. I've seen my computer handles it fine, but I do have a pretty good computer.
He's not lying.
I've seen other people on the Steam forum saying that it runs really badly for them, because there's obviously a lot of physics going on when you plow.
There's lots of physics.
A lot of physics.
Physics everywhere.
All over the place. Every bit of it. But I can't imagine that's going to run terribly well when there's like a, if you've got like a team of 50 people. Well, I want to have a fully manned castle and have it fully attacked by players. That's my ideal. The thing is, that's not far off, right? I mean, we can do this stuff now. Maybe that won't be achievable in this game, but you know, 5 years, we will have that.
That's kind of what EverQuest Next was trying to do.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know if it had the physics modelling stuff.
Well, it does have physics modelled dynamic, just voxel destruction and stuff.
Yeah.
But God knows what's happening with EverQuest now that SOE is Daybreak and...
Yeah, I know. Yeah.
But it feels like, I mean, it feels like the natural kind of... It's the same sort of thing in a way, like, you've got this amazing tool set. In the case, almost, I guess, the inverse of Evolve, where you've got this kind of great set of systems just based around physics and construction. And now you want the incentive to not only do things with that, but really attach meaning to it.
Yeah, this is the problem. I mean, actually, it's a problem I encounter quite a lot while doing the column I write for RPS on early access games. And that's that, a lot of games appear on early access where they do a lot of good work in kind of producing the assets for a game, and they produce kind of all the components that you might expect in the game, but they don't articulate a single gameplay loop which you could imagine being broadened into a full game. And that's really the kind of key thing when it comes to games, like everything else. I didn't mean that in a flippant way. Like, I mean, it's, you know, a lot of stuff appears on Early Access. Like, I looked at Eden Star, which is a kind of survival base building game, sort of tower defense thing where you're assaulted each night by bunches of insects.
Clouds of birds, bunches of insects.
Yeah, my plural word, by loads of these kind of bug creatures each night, but, and you'd think that would, the kind of gameplay that loop that they would be hoping to hit in their earliest incarnation, to, as like a proof of concept that this was workable, would be that your base building affected in some way the ability of these creatures to assault your base.
Yeah.
But it doesn't appear to be that those systems are interlinked yet. Like, they have all the art for your combat, and they have this nice kind of landscape, and they have the insects flocking towards you, and you can build this base. But actually, the ability to kind of strategically build your base in a particular location to limit the amount of attack you get, or to funnel enemies into, you know, kill zones and stuff like that, that just doesn't emerge from the systems they have, because they aren't yet linked up. But actually, I think if you're trying to sell people on the future vision of a game, that's the first thing you need. You don't actually need all the glossy art and the cool animations and stuff. You need that gameplay loop, because if that gameplay loop doesn't ever exist, then the game's boned.
Yeah. And this is the core of why survival is bollocks.
Yeah.
It really is, because survival is not in and of itself a mechanic.
No,
it's almost defined by the absence.
I've written angrily about this very fact on many occasions, because I play so many survival games, out of monetary necessity. it's just too easy, I think, for people to make survival games. There are really good survival games, but a lot of survival games just rely on the fact that you can put a number on top of the player's head and have that reach zero, and they're like, fine. Well, that's the mechanic of the game. It's a survival game. What more do you want? And you're like, well,
a lot more.
Yeah, actually.
And I wonder if, so my context for this is always going to be MMOs, because my first MMO was Ultima Online, and I passed through the life cycle of that game. Basically the Raf Costa MMOs into World of Warcraft, when the notion of what that genre was changed. And what it started off as was functionally everything the survival game currently taps into in terms of fantasy, but far more than most survival games currently deliver, where, you know, the fantasy of Ultima Online goes far beyond how do you survive in this wilderness, but it builds social systems and far more aspirational sort of game structures on top of just, you know, that is a game where you can live in the woods and eat rabbits. But it's also a game where you can be a merchant, move into town, you know, kind of have a life for yourself, build a city, found a thing, be an adventurer, whatever, all these other different things. That fantasy still exists. This notion of a persistent online world where both the large things and the small things matter is, I think, still really a powerful draw.
Definitely, yeah.
And what used to, I think, be the, it used to be MMOs and Worm, maybe look closer to it than a lot do. It worked particularly well for small communities. It's now, I think, expressed through the survival game movement in a far more stripped down form that's ultimately less interesting. Everyone who kind of like enters, you know, those games kind of end when your character enters a stable, survivable loop. There are exceptions. Like, I quite like Long Dark because it's so aggressive.
I haven't actually played that one.
It's good because it's so much about survival. You know, it's actually about trying to survive in a really hostile condition, and it builds a game out of the small, lots of small details of that, you know, of that scenario, from finding clothes to finding. It sort of answers that. It answers the kind of ultimately quite basic nature of the challenge itself with detail. So temperature, how much food you've had, the quality of the food, everything. So you're constantly fussing about details, and that distracts you long enough for you that when you die, you don't die. You die before you see the end of all the things the game has to offer, and you want to play it again. So that functions, but it doesn't ultimately go anywhere. But it feels like, given that early access is seemingly split between survival games, games where you build things with bricks forever, and given that Kickstarter is so occasionally enamored of sort of basically MMO concepts, Star Citizen is an MMO concept from a few years ago. It's the dream of Eve with walking in stations. These ideas are all one, really. you know, what you want from, I guess, what I would, you know, what people, medieval engineers as systems would work wonderfully within a survival game, MMO. Like, they bleed into each other eventually, and you want the reason you're defending your castle because you care about it, because that's where you live.
Yeah. Yeah.
You want the reason that you choose to creatively undermine the castle rather than break down the walls because you want to live there. But that requires a living game mechanic that, you know what I mean? Like, I'd love these ideas to, and basically everyone on Early Access, just make an MMO. Just all of you. All of you. Get in the Unity Asset Store. Pull everything together. And just make UO2.
I didn't mean to sound so down on Eden Star, actually, and I didn't mean to sound so down on it in the thing I wrote about it, but, like, I just didn't enjoy my time in it, and that's no real fault of the game, because it's in Early Access. So you can... I'm quite happy to play a game that is not currently workable or fun or enjoyable in Early Access, and yet still say, this is, you know, it's worth investing in this game's future. And it may well yet be a great game, but... There's just I have no confidence in it necessarily, because the essential part of it, which is the actual mechanics of it, aren't visible to me yet. You know, they haven't linked up.
You want a stronger sell than just that we will deliver this sort of feeling.
Yeah. And, you know, I feel bad, because obviously I don't think a lot of developers understand this yet, that they see it as an attack on an unfinished game, and that feels very unfair to them if you're critical of their early access build, in the way that you would be critical of a finished product. But you're still asking people to invest money in some kind of dream, and so I think it's fair to say, is it fun to play now, and to speculate on the prospects of achieving what it hopes to.
Yeah.
Because you're asking people to dig into their wallets.
And more to the point, whether if the, you know, you would want from any game the developer to have identified whatever that core loop is and realized it, at least in one instance. Even if you then subsequently make it more complex or add different modes or new mechanics, you want at least one loop to be possible. I remember ages ago on the podcast, like right back when we started talking about space-based DF9.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Which famously abandoned eventually. And I was so disappointed by that game. I bought it the moment it went on Steam because the notion of Dwarf Fortress with an interface that humans can use in space was like, yeah, so I'm down with that. I really would like that. And not only the base game was totally incomplete, because even though you could build rooms in space and ultimately have them populated, there was no game there. There was no reason to do any of those things. There was no way to kind of, play a session, you know, to kind of feel like you'd completed a loop. You know, what I look for now in an early access game is, to finish it or whatever is there and want them to make it more complex, not to want them to finish it. And I feel like the point you should put something in early access should be the point where whatever that core notion is basically functionally complete, but what it could benefit from is new extra ideas.
Yeah.
It's when you start to build outwards, not when you're kind of just getting to the end. Because otherwise, what are you inviting people to do? Run around your sandbox?
Yeah, well, I guess the thing is, I know, I feel much more favourable to medieval engineers, and I feel kind of weird about that, because I think I've talked to you in the pub previously about how a lot of sandbox games don't really do their thing for me, because I don't necessarily yearn for self-expression via games, because I'm more kind of adept at using other means of self-expression, like Photoshop or, you know, Google Docs. but I think that game gets away with it partly because it's kind of, you know, tickling my medieval pickle. It's not a phrase, is it? That's not even an idiom. Anyway, I think you probably get what I mean.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But
you
also,
like medieval things.
I like medieval things. But also because it's just the physics that it enacts is enough to kind of wow me, at least briefly. And so I think I've given it kind of like a bit of a free pass. But a fulsome functioning game with any kind of incentive inbuilt into it isn't there. It is just a sandbox game.
I mean, maybe that's the exception, like that a sufficiently kind of compelling construction tool can be fun in and of itself. It's that you, I mean, in that case, the space-based analogy is that space-based you know, the act of building the space base in space base, which is fun to say, is not fun. You are drag selecting rooms, and the rooms, you know, you maybe choose where a pot plant goes, but your kind of creative engagement is below a certain threshold. Mm. And that threshold is sort of key. If you're really engaged in the things you were saying about medieval engineers in terms of tolerances and kind of the materials really mattering.
Yeah.
Then that in itself is worthy. Like the best example of that is a game that's just leaving early access very soon, which is Kerbal Space Program, which I honestly believe is one of the best games on the PC, ever in terms of its just being brilliant. And that game, even though they've added campaign functions and more kind of formal game elements in terms of like science and research and funding and policies to your space agency and the management side of it, doesn't need it because self-directed challenge is...
It was always modelling something interesting.
Yeah.
That you couldn't get from any other kind of experience.
And modelling it to just a sufficient degree of complexity that setting your own goals was enough, where it isn't in other kinds of games. Like, a lot of survival games assume that setting your own goals will be enough when your own goals are not fade to black. And that's not interesting. Whereas, you know, I've been seeing, now that Kerbal's coming out, I'm seeing people in the office play it probably for the first time for review. Mm. And that's really interesting, watching the shit rockets they're building and kind of wanting to help but not wanting to intrude, because I played a lot of that game and I remember the shit rockets I built. And in learning, I expanded my brain and learned how rockets actually function, which is, it's a similar fantasy at that point to the medieval castle thing, right? I guess what medieval engineers does need is the barbarians button, which is the equivalent of launching your rocket in...
Yeah, the thing is that's never going to work unless you have people, large numbers of people defending. At least it's not going to fulfill my fantasy, because a lot of the castle designs do require multiple defenders.
Yeah.
Like, you know.
Trace Italienne is not a Trace Italienne without archers.
Well, exactly. There's no point building walls that overlook each other unless you have people to look over the walls.
Yeah. Yeah, that's fair.
Yeah.
Man.
Castles.
Get them to work with the Mountain Blade guys.
Yes, that would be fucking cool.
Yeah.
That's got to
I would just play that. Shall we do questions from questions?
Yes, we shall do. Kian writes in to say, good evening, suspicious package and blunt metal weapon.
Your package is suspicious.
Your metal weapon's blunt.
Thank you. This did get
sticky. Hello sort from the past, he says. I'm still desperately trying to catch up with the podcast. It's only March 2014 at the moment, but I shouldn't be too much longer.
Jesus.
Christ almighty. I have a question for questions from questions. Oh, sorry. He has a question for questions from question. It does also come with a silly anecdote that you can shake your heads at. Have you ever been so incredibly excited for a game to release, but for whatever reason were unable to play it in a manner that you were happy with? Your computer or internet isn't good enough, etc. To such a degree that you would wait until everything is just right to boot it up. I'm also curious about the flip side. Have you ever had a game or concept you were so desperate to see visualized that you didn't care how bad it was or how early in alpha it was, that you just had to play it?
Written grammar. Confusing to read.
The funny anecdote is that I picked up StarCraft II Heart of the Swarm when it came out almost 2 years ago. At the time, I was able to play Wings of Liberty without issue on my gaming laptop. However, the specs changed for HOTS, not the obviously superior HOTS that I play.
Or the Hearth of the Stone.
The game could run on a laptop, but everything had to be turned off or reduced to its lowest setting. The result was I had a game that, in my opinion, looked worse than the original StarCraft. I only played the first level and turned it off. I decided then and there to finally take the plunge and get myself a proper gaming rig. Fast forward to the present day, which is 2 years from then, and for various reasons, moving country being one of them, beside me sits only an almost gaming rig. I have had to wait another month or two before I can afford a decent graphics card. Hell, by the time I finally get to play HOTS, again, the inferior HOTS, Legacy of the Void might already be out. I don't know what Legacy of the Void is.
It's the next StarCraft game.
Oh, right, I thought they'd finished with that.
No, it's a trilogy.
Oh, God, right. All because I wanted what I thought was the right experience. Isn't human stubbornness a wonderful thing? Keep up the entertaining work. I'll hear you in 2015. And he also proposes a toast for ludonarrative dissonance.
Hooray!
Hurrah. Hurrah. Mm.
Weirdly, I did almost exactly that with Wings of Liberty.
Oh, right.
Yeah, I upgraded my PC because Wings of Liberty was a game that wouldn't run StarCraft, the first StarCraft 2 of the three StarCraft 2s. Huh. I think if I'm going to enter, like, the only territory within which I'm weirdly properly precious about the circumstances in which I play a game is BioWare games, which I guess people who listen to the podcast a lot will know that just an area of...
Really? I didn't know you were
assorted mania. just assorted weird mental tics and patterns and pathologies that I don't really have any control over. I guess an instance of me being weird, a particular instance would be, being so excited for Mass Effect 3 over the course of about 3 years, that by the time it finally came out, I decided that I was going to play it on PC rather than on console, because I had Mass Effect 1 came out, while I didn't have a gaming PC.
Hmm.
And I did all my playing on Xbox 360, so I played Mass Effect 1 and 2 on Xbox 360.
Hmm.
And Mass Effect 3 at this point was 3 or 4 months away, and I realized that now that at that point I worked a PC gamer, I was going to play it on PC and could do, but obviously my saves were on the Xbox. And I would never bear to start with a default save or even really to configure my save using a save configuration tool. Mm. But that doesn't count to me. The experience has to have been had on the platform.
Oh,
like,
man.
That experience is not something you can fake.
Right.
Like, it has to have existed.
Yeah, you can't fake that madness.
But everything had to be right. So I rebought the entire series and all of its DLC. I got a USB stick, plugged it into my Xbox, made an image of the Xbox hard drive, hacked that image to get access to the Xbox save files, opened the Xbox save files in a text editor to gain access to the number string that indicated what Shepard's face looked like, translated that number string into, because the first Mass Effect doesn't actually indicate the values for given sliders. They are calculated from zero, where zero is the center of the slider. So a face might go to plus 50 or minus 50 or whatever. Translated the numbers in the Xbox save files into movements along to the right or left along the slider, and then using that exactly to the exact point of accuracy, recreated my Commander Shepard on the PC.
Man.
In Mass Effect 1.
If you told me this 2 years ago, I'd never agree to live with you.
It's too late now. Mm-hmm. With the one exception that I fixed his dumb nose. Because I'd lived with that dumb nose for 2 games on the Xbox. Then my marginally more handsome Commander Shepard created, I then played through all of Mass Effect 1 and all of Mass Effect 2 and all of its DLC just in time for Mass Effect 3 to come out. So that's the most staggering broad act of over-preparation I've done.
Yes. possibly most people will have ever done.
However, also, but there's a smaller one. Every time I play a BioWare game, like a big RPG. Mm. Like, I more self-consciously want to kind of immerse myself in the game than with other games of any type, really. So, I tend to play them with, like, a main light off, maybe if there's another light in the room, with the volume slightly higher than I would play other games. And occasionally, if I haven't played them for a while, I find it helpful to listen to the soundtrack a little bit before I boot it up.
Chris. Do you wear your fucking N7 t-shirt as well?
I don't have one.
I've got one. Do you want to borrow it?
No. No, that'd be lame.
I did play...
What I do is cool.
I did play Deus Ex Human Revolution wearing a Serif branded t-shirt, actually. It's a good experience.
Do you ever wonder... Do you ever worry that we're not cool?
No, I never worry about that.
Okay. Can we answer a different question?
It's already a certainty. JR says, Dear Crate and Crowbar, recently received my indie box for this month. I wondered if I could have your opinions on this enterprise now that it's been running long enough to be proven legitimate. I, for one, love both the surprise of a new game each month and the reassurance that they don't need to phone home to some terrible third-party DRM service. So just to explain what IndieBox is, I think it's like a subscription service where you get maybe a trio or more of indie games each month, but they come as special editions, so you get loads of... tat with them. And so he goes on to say, the little extras mean even games I already own are a delight to receive. They even gave me a Hessian bag to hide SteamWorld Dig in so I could pretend that I didn't already own it. And the mix of popular favourites and small unknowns is well chosen. So how about it, lads, and possibly other? Is it time to # bring back the box? Or is such a service the domain of the paranoid, the nostalgic, or the merely foolish? Torts for Peter, he says. All and sundry. which I think is...
Torts for Peter all and sundry,
exactly,
I guess.
Yes.
Yeah.
Quite good. I don't know. I think the fewer physical possessions that I own is probably for the best, to be honest.
Yeah, until you can just become a cloud of birds.
Yes. I used to live with a man who said, who was a samurai, and he used to claim that the only things that you should own in life should be so small that you could carry them up a bamboo tree. That didn't extend to his motorcycle that he had, but he did repeatedly crash his motorcycle. So I think in some way that was, his innate philosophy trying to work itself out through a midlife crisis.
What a tragedy. This is unrelated. What a tragedy it's been that a kind of such a romantic and noble notion like the samurai.
Mm.
When I hear it, I now just think midlife crisis.
Mm, yeah. What do you think about physical possessions / this particular service?
I have a complicated relationship with them. Some things I like, some things I don't like, almost anything. I think it's, I wasn't actually aware of this service till we got this email. It very much seems to me like one of those artisanal grocery or beer services people subscribe to, where you're sent a selection of microbrews once a month.
See, I was thinking of doing that.
Yeah, so exactly.
Than in my exactly. Slag it off.
No, I'm not about to slag it off. I'm saying it is of arguably questionable utility, but I wouldn't blame anyone for thinking that it's nice and choosing to spend their money on it.
Yeah, that's quite right. Yeah.
If I wanted beer cheaply and effectively, there are places I can go to the supermarket down the road and get a deal. But if I want someone to deliver me a nice basket with hand-chosen artisanal microbrews in it, I have that right, and I also, other people also have the right to think I'm a bellend. But everything's fine, basically.
Yeah.
I'm glad it exists, I'm glad someone's getting something out of it, and that I suppose the kind of the broader, possibly cynical positive is that it's a interesting games distribution enterprise that is making its customers happy, delivering what it claims to deliver on, and broadly not being shite.
It'll be interesting to see. I mean, I don't know what numbers it's doing, but the subscription, I think, starts at something like $20 a month. So it's quite steep for a subscription service where you're getting indie games, which have often been out for a large amount of time, probably cost less than $5 each, and... You know, you might already own them as well.
Yeah.
So it's quite a big risk, I don't think that necessarily negates it as a value proposition for its customers, because presumably they're getting something else out of it. They want the kind of nice Luftrausers, pin badges or whatever they send out with them, or the
Luftrausers Luftrausers.
Yeah, that would be awesome. Yeah. Why did they miss that marketing opportunity? Or the Escape Goat, you know, plushie, whatever it is. Yeah. Not plushie, it's a paper craft thing.
I mean, there is something in that there's, you know, if people are investing value in making the experience of receiving games satisfying again, then that's got something to it, and that's worth investing in. Like, not to kind of like double back, kick evolve once more in the belly as it rolls around on the floor and then retreat again. The experience of purchasing that game is an absolute horror because there are so many versions of it, and because whatever you choose, you're choosing to not get something else.
Mm.
And there's no way of buying that game digitally without feeling like you're a chump.
Hmm.
Basically, who isn't valued by the people that want you to spend money on the game.
You know exactly what you're getting with this service, won't
you?
Yeah. Well, you ironically don't.
What you get is something, that, you know, you've fully opted in for that experience.
You couldn't have not wanted it.
Yeah. You've committed an amount of money that you accept and understand for a product that you kind of understand the parameters of, whereas so many modern games are about committing money now, and potentially being asked to spend in perpetuity because of terrible bollocks.
Andrew Duncan says, yes. Dear Graham Smith and the spiders from Bath.
Shit.
Graham, he says, who isn't here, on the popular internet website, Rock Paper Shotgun, your bio describes you as too tall. This makes me curious. As a fellow member of the tall, I'm used to this kind of slander from the diminutive majority. And I was wondering if you are objectively tall or just not quite as minute as they are. I'm always disappointed when someone is likened to a mountain and I like to find out they're only a gnat's fart over 6 foot. For the purposes of helping you create a Top Trump star card game about your listeners, I should disclose that I'm 6 foot four. Thanks for reading, mostly Graham. Andrew Duncan. Well, as we know, the only thing that makes tall people tall are short people.
Indeed.
Like us. So like you us. Should be fucking grateful.
You should. And Graham is legitimately tall.
Is he?
I would guess that he's 6 foot two.
Could be. I don't know. He has the demeanour of a tall person rather than perhaps the actual...
He does. He looms.
He looms, yes.
I mean...
But in a good way.
Yeah.
Like a friendly giant.
Mm.
Looking over his flock.
You and I, the small people of the podcast, with Pip as a regular guest, as the, you know, the notable outlier of the small people being 4'11". I guess Senior's pretty tall, but he stoops. Mm. So I have no idea how tall Tom Francis is. I think he's sort of just sort of like a platonic medium of human beings. He's exactly averagely tall.
Could be.
Yeah.
There you go. I hope we've cleared that up for you.
Yeah, if you'd like more substantial ratings on who could fight whom and for how long, then we'll do our best.
Ben Monroe says, "Gentlemen, I've noticed a strange thing happening to Steam recently. For many years, games created in the land of the rising sun had been woefully underrepresented on Steam until recently. Searching the term JRPG will now return a multitude of results. Popular JRPGs such as Final Fantasy, Valkyria Chronicles, and the YS series? What's YS?
Ys, I think.
They're all available at fairly reasonable prices, and it's not just JRPGs. Anime, visual novel, and hentai with tags I'd never expected to see on Steam. So what is going on? How come there is suddenly a PC audience for Japanese games, and have any of you braved the strange taste of the JRPG or visual novel? Cheers, guys. Ben Monroe." I haven't played any visual novels. I played some games. I forget what it's called now. Ugh! It's not Princess Maker. It is the other one. Queen. Long Live the Queen.
Long Live the Queen.
Yes, and there are a bunch of games of those ilk, which are really interesting. I suppose that maybe that, I don't know what the exact parameters of a visual novel are, but they are more like choose your own adventures with some kind of stat modelling going on as well. So you kind of go down this pachinko set of choices, but also each pachinko set of choices allows you to upgrade certain parts of your personality so that when you encounter skill checks later, that you can succeed or fail them. And I found, Long Live the Queen to be, absolutely fantastic, really, really, enjoyable. Although I didn't really get on with the manga art in it, which I thought was cutesy and foul in the extreme. So I don't know. I don't know if there has been... I mean, is there really a Japanese resurgence so much as...
I think it's more that Steam got bigger.
Yeah. Mm.
Like,
opened its doors, basically, to everything.
I mean, if you know, the sort of notable ones I can think of is something like, and I still don't know how to fucking pronounce this, Resetair? Which was the game about running an item shop in a JRPG, was one of the first Japanese indie games to get ported both to the PC, or it might have been a PC game originally, but specifically translated into English. And that was cool. With regards to JRPGs in general, I think recently there's been a run of, pretty late Final Fantasy ports. So like the various Final Fantasy 13 games. If you're not familiar, Final Fantasy 13 is 3 games. And apparently they're pretty much all dump. I know that Sam from PC Gamer reviewed Final Fantasy 13 2 recently and had some kind of bored, tired, and upset and frustrated epiphany while trying to solve a giant clock puzzle that made no sense. So those games, I suspect the reason they're coming to PC now, the reason that Final Fantasy VII has kind of dropped onto PC and that there are more of these games arriving is because publishers have realized that it really makes no sense not to have your game available on Steam if you possibly can, because someone will buy it. It doesn't make all of those ports good, and I don't think it really constitutes like a cultural shift. Not that it's necessarily necessary. Like, I've played JRPG style games my entire life, just on different platforms. But I would arguably still probably want to play them on a DS or something.
Yeah, it's weird how fitting they are for that
platform,
and not really, I can't imagine sitting down and playing Fire Emblem on a PC, really.
No.
Actually, maybe I can.
Fire Emblem's the exception, because Fire Emblem's fucking great,
mm.
and the fact that there isn't an equivalent on PC is a genuine problem. but like, but more broadly, like the experience of like, you know, that combination of, I might dig it out for the show notes actually. There was a really interesting, it's very, very technical, but there was an interesting article, today I found via Twitter. I'll try and dig it out, which is just technical documentation for Final Fantasy VII's engine. Like down to the very specific way it uses memory, where it uses RAM. And it's about how they built that game and how they built this thing that could only work on a CD-ROM, which is why Final Fantasy moved from Nintendo to Sony. And then and it's really interesting because it kind of, it's as interesting as you're ever going to get an exploration of the way that technology informs game design. And so the reason that you can't equip a new weapon in combat in that game is partly a design decision. You know, when you're in the turn-based combat sequences, you're stuck with the equipment you went in with. And it's also because the way the game's architecture functions, there is no pathway between combat and the menu. There is only, like, the menu sits at the center, so the menu links to the world map and, regular exploration, but combat is, and combat is both linked to those things, but they're kind of separated. So there's no way for the game to communicate between those two different modules of its design. So it's interesting things like that, but I think the JRPG generally is a bit like that. For me, it's very compartmental. It's defined by incredibly compartmentalized game systems that kind of work together in a kind of satisfying way, but in a way that I prefer to consume piecemeal now, rather than sit, like, and play for hours and hours and hours. I'd want something more immersive or coherent from a sit-down PC game, but it works well for portables. So.
You ever going to play a visual novel dating game? Hentai dating game?
No.
Relatedly, Alex Vaughan asks, what is the best method for procuring Thurston's mucky butter?
We should explain this. Should explain this.
I don't know what you mean. I think it's a perfectly reasonable question. To be honest, I think the better question is, how can you stop him from producing his mucky butter continuously? In the kitchen sometimes. Terrible. James Vokes writes in to say, if there was a sudden revival in consoles having mascots, Sonic, Crash, etc., and the PC needed one, who would it be?
God, I think...
You've not said Zool nearly quick enough.
That's an Amiga game.
Was it on Amiga?
Yeah.
Oh, I played on PC. Fuck that.
Whatever.
What was Cool Spot on?
I don't know. Zool's Amiga 1200 for me. I don't know if that's...
Oh, right, okay.
Yeah, I mean, that would mean he is a ninja from the nth dimension, so...
I was joking as well. Zool is terrible.
No, he's not. Tread softly.
Okay.
Tread on my dreams. Or my fond memories of something that I was too much of a child and an idiot to really understand. God, I don't know. Like, I think, attempts to create a mascot for the PC have ended in,
David Braben.
Yeah.
Oh, right. Sorry.
Embarrassment. David Braben. Now that is the answer.
Can we have him stuffed?
No. But okay. you don't need to. Just, I think, yeah. No, actually, not even then. Like, I'm trying to think of a potential mascot for the PC that hasn't been problematized by questionable behavior from one part of the internet or another. In Braben's case, it's not Braben himself, but the notion of the kind of, genial patriarch dreamer of PC gaming. Forever tarnished by the failure of Goddess. you can't have Gabe Newell because then you associate yourselves with parts of Reddit that can often do one. And then.
This is amazingly segueing, isn't it?
It is, yeah. What do you pick? Like, what represents the breadth and diversity of PC gaming? Do you pick Spelunky guy?
It's better than fucking Gordon Freeman, is it? Do you remember the years and years and years when people were picking their, like, the top 10 best characters in video games? Gordon Freeman would be in there, despite the fact he literally doesn't have any personality whatsoever.
Yeah, he is 100% a cipher for the player.
Yeah.
And the fact that that's
probably a good reason. If the arguments for that had been exactly that.
Yeah, but at that point, it's that Time Person of the Year couple where they made it you. You know what I mean? So,
Yeah. I don't know.
I don't know, you want something, because, I mean, really, it is that kind of you thing, because if there's anything that, I'm quite resistant to notions of what defines the medium, because I think, for me, gaming on the PC is defined by, having every option.
Yeah.
You know, it's a non-partisan approach, and people desperately try and make it partisan. But
what's so good about it is it's very diverse,
really. Yeah. You know, if you want to play console games, you can, with a pad. Go for it. Do it.
Mm.
If you want to play the most hardcore Sims, do it. If you want to play
hentai vision novels,
do it. Like, I don't really...
Don't fill your boots. Don't fill your boots. That would...
That's a terrible use of boots. Mm. I've got tissues. But the point is, there's no one symbol that kind of sums that up, other than, I don't know, somebody making decisions for themselves.
Mm. Craig McCormick writes in to say, PC Master Race, discuss.
For reasons that I may have just gestured at, that whole concept is bollocks.
You know, I hate it, but I hate it not because it is in any way tasteless, although it clearly is kind of like a tasteless phrase to swing around, because obviously it does explicitly reference eugenics and those sort of issues. But it annoys me because its acquisition by a large number of gamers as something positive goes in the face of the fact that it was intended as irony.
Joke.
Yeah. Like, it's just completely, there's nothing more, I don't know if you had this when you were a kid, but like, when you're in the, kind of like, the playground, and you make some kind of, like, rakishly witty, but also self-deprecating observation about yourself.
And someone else buys into it.
Yeah, and some lunkhead says, wow, yeah, you're right. I'm going to think that I made that observation about you and mock you for it. And then they mock you for it. And you're like, you didn't win this.
Yeah.
But you're so stupid that you think you did. But I gave this to you because I was trying to be funny. But you don't understand that. That is the most annoying thing in the entire universe. And
it is something that every short person understands.
Yeah. Yes. Yes.
It's the moment where you go, God, someone's going to help me with that shelf. And they go, because you're really small.
Yeah, brilliant.
Yeah.
But then, you know, PC Master Race, the people adopting that, not realizing that it was obviously a joke about the self-seriousness and superiority of, you know, PC gamers, potentially, is the most depressing fucking thing.
Yeah, I mean...
But for that reason alone, for the sake of preserving irony and eradicating stupidity, it should be banned. Not because it's offensive.
It's pointless tribalism. And it does nothing to advance the hobby or even really explicate your hobby. Something that I'm sensitive to now that I've spent a significant portion of my life, answering emails from GamerGate, is that, you know, people get a lot from feeling like they belong in a community and there's a community there for them that represents their beliefs, and that, You know, I'm in no position to judge what people choose to assign themselves to, because I was a member of the Star Wars role-playing community for several years in the mid-noughties, which is, like, you know what I mean? Like, glass houses.
Yes. Right? Yeah,
like, what people choose to kind of assign themselves to. And to a degree, ask him to be critical about the language they use in terms of master race and so on, is asking them to introduce a degree of historical context and sensitivity that is previously completely alien. And in a way, it's not that it's irrelevant, but it is secondary to the emotional need that community is fulfilling, which is the need to feel like you're part of a group. The problem emerges when it becomes, it's the master part of it, really is the problem. It's the notion that you're superior to somebody else because of the games they enjoy versus the games you enjoy, when that's complete bollocks. And there really is no backing it up, and also you don't need it. If you enjoy something, you enjoy it on your own terms, and you're no better or worse than anybody else. Like, the fact that, you know, I went through this phase of my life where I didn't play PC games at all, and now I'm the deputy of a PC gamer, doesn't impact my ability to be critical about games. My interest in being critical about games came from the Xbox. It fundamentally came from AAA games. You know, the first game I really cared enough about to want to write about was the original Bioshock, and then, like, the original Metro. And, you know, like, the notion that your consumer decisions, and this is really the core of a lot of problems with gamer identity in general, the notion that your decisions as a consumer have anything to do with your tastes or sensibilities or identity as a an aficionado of a culture is bullshit. Like, why should that be the thing that determines what you're eligible to enjoy or not? Like, it's fast food as far as cultural identity comes. It's easy and it's right there, and there's a subreddit full of people who'd applaud you for doing it. So much so that when PC Gamer ran an editorial saying, let's try and, like, you know,
cool it, guys.
Cool it.
no more kind of forceful,
momentarily, I believe the PC Master Race subreddit adopted the Luftwaffe's flag as their logo to protest our protestation at their use of Nazi imagery. Like, no, fuck you, we're gonna use more Nazi imagery. Which, at this point, you've gotten in a one-upmanship competition that ends badly for everybody. Mm. Like, who wins there? Like, what's the point?
But
like,
again, they're being the lunkheads who don't quite realize context in which they're making these things. Like, you're still losing. You're just losing harder now.
Yeah, exactly. They double down on
losing. But you think you're winning still.
Yeah, it's like, your experience of games is divorced from the decisions you make as a consumer. Your ability to think about the games you play has nothing to do with how much money you've spent. And you have every right to be proud of your rig and to want to show off the cool cooling system you've built yourself or whatever it is. But that does not make you better than the person who is sitting in their pants playing Destiny on their PS4. In no material fact does it make you better than them.
Says a man who occasionally does play Destiny.
I got up at 6 o'clock in the morning to play Destiny in my pants because I needed to farm Glimmer prior to the expiry of the Iron Banner event because I wanted a shotgun. Right? I'm not fucking better than that. I understand that.
Yeah.
And that's why PC Master Race is bullshit.
We're all in the gutter, but we all look to the stars.
Yeah. And then grind stars so that we can unlock bigger stars for hats. The end.
The end. And that's all the questions we have. It's all the podcasts we have.
And it's all I've got time for. We want pizza now.
Yeah, please. Let's get it. Yeah. Our faces. You can send us emails if you want.
Should I do this bit?
Oh, I don't know. Go on then.
All right. So if you want to send us a question, you can do so. And we'd warmly invite it.
Please do.
Please do. It's always a pleasure. Sorry, I've completely... I'm sorry, I'm flagging. I'm going to start this again. Why is this hard like that?
I don't know. That's maybe our booze per person ratio has increased.
We've broken the booze per person. Blah, blah, blah. That's even hard to say.
Oh, man. Shall I do the ending?
No, it's fine. It's okay, fine. It's fine. Right. It's fine. It's fine. If you'd like to send us a question, and you should, you can email us at questions@creatingcrowbar.com. You can leave a question on the forum at creatingcrowbar.com. Oh, God, I should have bought booze for two people. creatingcrowbar.com/forum, which is where our forum is, and people are. The questions can be. You can tweet us at creatingcrowbar. Very, very small questions. Short questions that fit in 140 characters or less. Alternatively, should you wish to do so, you can follow us as individuals, both in person and on the internet. there's only two of us this week. Mm-hmm. I'm at C Thurston, that's C-T-H-U-R-S-T-E-N.
I didn't need to clarify there's only two of us this week. I think if they got this far, they probably have realised that.
I was really reminding myself.
Okay, thank you. I'm at Marsh Davis, it's D-A-V-I-E-S. Thanks for listening, everybody.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
We're very sorry.
Bye.
Yay! Yes, please.